Hello and welcome to this month's Mega Game Assembly podcast. Thank you very much for downloading. We've got a cracking episode for you this evening. Matty, what have we got in store for our dear, dear listeners?
So today, I haven't been chatting with them today. We chatted about a month and a half ago. But
don't let them peek behind the curtain.
Yes, we don't just record things and then, you know, the magic of podcasting just edits everything. It's a little bit more involved than that. A little while ago, I sat down with Deborah and Peter. I also didn't sit down with them because COVID.
You had a virtual get together.
We had a virtual get together, yes. And we had a bit of a chat around historical games and particularly around gender roles in historical games. Yeah, it's a challenging topic, and it's not an exhaustive conversation by any means. I think there's some really interesting discussion there.
Yeah, I think in line with many of the other things we've been talking about, it's a difficult conversation, but an important conversation, and by no means exhaustive. There's plenty more to be learnt and plenty more to be enacted, but it's a good chat, I think. A good chat. Okay, well, without further ado, enjoy.
So we have here today Peter Nixon and Deborah Southwell. I'm very, very excited for this conversation. We started it last week and had some technical difficulties, so we're having a take two today. Thank you so much for joining me yet again.
That's fine, Maddie. Thank you.
Glad to be here.
Deborah, can we start with an introduction from you, please?
Yes, I'll just provide a bit of background. I'm middle class, I'm white, I'm cisgendered, I'm actually old, I'm a 65-year-old, so in Britain that's old. I'm a Westerner, a dual citizen, I'm British and Australian, and as such I consider myself to be very privileged. And I want to make it clear that while I'm speaking about female roles and the aspects of, I wanted it to be clear what my perspective was. So I can't speak for Black, Asian and minority ethnic groups. I really can't even speak for white people of different classes or different backgrounds to me. But mine is one story and mine is one perspective. And I hope that you get really lots of opportunities to be able to find out about the other perspectives of other women as well. I have only recently started attending Mega Games over the last couple of years, and that's been a fascinating experience. But I've also been in situations with that where I might have been the only woman that was there. My very first game, I was the only woman, but fortunately there was a woman controller. I've been in games where women have been really distressed by aspects of the game, including the role design for the females and the behaviours of some of the male players. And that really got me thinking about what the role of females were as they were presented in games. And this was, you know, everything from historical to science fiction games or futuristic games. And so it's really great to be able to have a discussion with the two of you about this.
That was great, Deborah. So demographically, I am the opposite of a minority in pretty much every way. So, you know, just let that inform everything about me as well. But, you know, beyond that, you know, we're here to talk about the glory and the love of historically inspired mega games and all the potential and pitfalls within that historical framework that is used, you know, so often. It seems in the UK that up until recently, more than half, maybe even the vast majority, were all historical mega games, which is interesting because here in the U.S. and I'll go ahead and start diving into the conversation. It's because our background in the U.S. mega game scene is more board games than it was historical wargaming. Almost all the mega games, I am struggling to think of historically inspired mega games besides the ones I've made, just in general. They're all fictional, and part of the reasoning is that dealing with these historical matters can be so tricky, and you know, people will pounce on you, you know, for better and worse. Like, if you mess up, you should be definitely yelled at, right? But it can be a bit harsh. But you know, historical games, in my opinion, are one, more rewarding in many ways. Obviously, it varies game to game, and two, completely possible. Like, do not get freaked out by tackling such big historical themes or whatever.
You said, Pete, that you found historical mega games more rewarding. Do you think you could tell us a little bit more about what it is about them that you find more rewarding?
Yes. So, maybe I put my shoe in my mouth there just briefly. But I will say that my personal preference is historical mega games for two reasons. One, I love learning, and mega games have been like surprisingly good at teaching me new things. I think it was pretty remarkable about how much I've learned through these short introductory experiences, how much I've learned about the broad conflicts and what the different, you know, political factions were at the time and what the mindsets were and what they were debating and what the restraints and what the strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, and I forget what the T is. And then two is that, you know, we're going to talk about the pitfalls of historical gaming, but there are also pitfalls of fictional gaming as well, which the main pitfall that I come across a lot is that in a crash course experience like a mega game, it's really, really hard to get players to care about this broad fictional universe as much as they would if it was an analogous historical setting.
I think this is one of the things that historical games can be really fantastic at, because looking at a historical period, you know, there's an interesting setting, and the complexity and nuance in the power balance or events taking place and their repercussions, and you know, all of the different factions that have competing aims, or, you know, some are on the same page with some things, but not so much on the other. You know, I think those kind of complex settings are in so many ways just fantastic mega game settings. And essentially, I think historical games just really have a strength of they can really produce really, really interesting, nuanced scenarios, basically.
Yeah, I'm actually really interested. How faithful to history with your mega games do you feel like you? I mean, I guess in my mind, there's a spectrum from, you know, the guys that play the sort of, whether it's wargaming or what, but they want that historical accuracy. And that's a really high priority for them. And then at the other end of the spectrum, there's almost, it's almost like an archetype, like, you know, we're playing this war game and these are the sort of main features and it's based on this historical aspect. But, you know, we're prepared to be perhaps a bit more flexible about how it goes. So do you see that sort of, spectrum, or how do you see that sort of thing, and how would you place yourself on that sort of a spectrum?
Oh, I mean, I'm definitely towards the of the two options listed, I'm definitely leaning towards the later, less accurate in simulation gaming. I don't think, I mean, it's just not important. Like, I mean, if you wanted to be historically accurate, you know, you might as well, like, I don't know, form a country and start a war again or something like that. Like, it just doesn't make any sense, you know? You're here to game. And I think one of the, like, really strong historical games, the theme of the games inform the game design. You know, you're not adapting in a, like, I mean, well, you could be, honestly. I don't think that'd be a problem at all. But it's important to think about critically, like, what is the... Something I think about a lot when I'm designing is, what did the people at the time actually feel? Like, how did it feel to be a frontline commander in World War One? Yeah. Like, that is, you know, there's a certain futility, right? So if you build a combat system where, you know, you there are vast tracts of land and there's no element of disillusionment involved, I think that's kind of unfaithful. And, you know, to be fair, it could not, you know, if you're the point of your game, and I think most games should have a point, to be honest. I think designers who don't have kind of like a thesis statement with their designs are missing an opportunity. You know, they're missing a chance to really develop something that could be more powerful. But if the point of your game is just to talk about the tactics and strategy of the war, like, that's fine. You know what I mean? But that's also been done a lot. You know what I mean? Like, we can branch out, you know, we can go bigger.
How do you manage, like, the roles for women in the sort of games that you play, given that there were a lot of restrictions around female roles, the female's lives? How do you manage that in the games that you play?
So first off, let me say, obviously, like, I'm not an expert in this regard, right? Yeah. Two of the designs that I'm working on currently, one is a Mexican Revolution design and the other is a Russian Revolution design. So in both those designs, there was a strong sense of female empowerment and female equality, right? So it's a case of, I want to avoid those issues by, like, choosing settings where, females are roughly viewed on an even playing field. If you do not choose that, you really got to consider, is it important to have gendered roles at all if it ends up being detriment to one sex or the other, right? And obviously most time it would be detrimental to the female sex, or gender, excuse me. Yeah. The moral of the story is that if you are going to include gendered roles, there has to be, one, a reason, right? Let's take this World War I design, right? Like, obviously there was no female, World War I front commanders that I know of, right? But is the gendered aspect of people's genders important in this setting? And I would argue, no, not really. Like, the point of the game is not to explore gender roles and how that affects. The point of the game is to explore them in, like, the World War I front or whatever the point of your design is. Now, obviously, in real life, you guys being female, you guys can't, you can't not be female, right? At least not easily. And so I think people are kind of glossing over this really, really simple solution to what is obviously a very complex problem, which is players don't need to be the actual, like, gender, and they don't need to embody it if it's not important to the design. And like, you just need to stress to players who are being unprofessional or whatever, like, hey, you're being unprofessional, and, like, I would kick him out in a heartbeat if I heard, there was, like, weird sexist remarks going on between, front commanders of the same army. Like, that would be that would be immediate kick out, bar none. Not to say that, obviously, discrimination and this kind of, how do you even articulate it, this active and passive discomfort that happens throughout the games for female players is both personal and also systemic.
I think there's definitely a couple of ways to take it. I think one of the ways I'm planning on approaching it, so I'm also in the midst of designing a historical game set at the end of the Edo period in Japan. So at that point, women really don't have a lot of rights. But I'm doing something that I've seen a couple of LARPs do, where they say, well, this is a historical setting, with an asterisk that there is no gender discrimination. Women can achieve all of the, take on all of the roles that were available to men at the time. And you can play the game as a woman playing a woman at the time. But, we are just sort of, making a slight change to the setting to say there are no limitations to you in this setting. With the gender that you want to play the game, there are not going to be any restrictions for you. So I think that's one way to take it. I've also played, I think that this was the first game we actually played together, Deborah, Ed Silverstone's By the Grace of God, one of the few historical games that I've played, because I have to say I have not played a lot. But I was playing Queen Henrietta Maria, the wife of Charles I. I went sort of all out on a costume, although that's separate, not particularly relevant, but I just thought I'd mention it because that was a really fun aspect of the game for me. But there were no differences in that. In that game, all of the roles were named, and all of the roles were gendered because they were based on historical characters. I think everyone who was female at the game was in a female role, but there were a few roles which were female but which were played by men, because I think there'd only been three women who'd signed up to the game, and I think there were four female roles or something like that. But in that game, I didn't sort of feel the gender of my role so much as a limitation, because what I could do in the game was exactly the same as I could do as any other role in the game could do. I mean, that was partly because I was playing an extremely, you know, powerful role in the game. You know, I was the wife of the king, but it is, I think there's definitely ways in which you can do it and it feel less problematic as a player.
Yeah, I agree with that, Maddie, because I think we had a lot more the women's roles had a lot more agency in them. And that was, I think that was a part of the time as well. But I think one of the things that we had discussed or touched on briefly last week was a historical game where it was set in Greece and I've forgotten the name of the guy, Matty.
Funeral games.
And it was Alexander had died, and it was what was going to happen to his. Yep. And so it was Alexander and what he had died and what was going to happen. And the actual designer was really keen to have roles for women. So really worked hard. I mean, his intent was to make some really interesting roles for the women to play, for females to be able to play. It went massively pear-shaped for those of us that were actually the females in this. Yeah, you know, it was a dreadful, dreadful experience. And so and it's very difficult for us to even laugh at it. Well, certainly difficult for me to laugh about it, and I imagine for Matty it's still difficult to laugh about it. But yeah, because it was so, you know, no, it was so traumatic for us. And it did bring up, I think, a lot of things about the role of females in some of these, you know, historical games, whether it's a war game or whether it's just exploring something like the dynamics that were happening after Alexander died.
Obviously, I don't know the specifics of funeral games, and I don't know if you want to get into it. I would be interested to hear what exactly went wrong.
I think we can touch on some of the main things that happened. I know Rob has done a lot of heart searching, and some of the other designers that were working with him that are really quite committed to, you know, involving females were absolutely you know, mortified by what actually happened. So, you know, but I think we can sort of look at it as an exemplar rather than sort of just try and, you know, it's not an attempt to tear it apart so much as a way to look at some of the issues and how we might tease some of that out. In the funeral games, the roles of most of the women, well, the female roles, the roles that were female characters, were basically about trying to get yourself or your daughter a really good match, and then for her to sort of fall pregnant, and you know, there was a rolling of the dice, and then you got a certain amount of money or something when you actually rolled the dice. It meant that you got a son. I took exception to a lot of it, because it's sort of like, I have four kids, been there, done that. But it's sort of like, once I'd had the one son, that was it. You know, it was like, okay, I can't get any more money. And so I was actually arguing back that, you know, if the only agency I have as a female character is to be able to produce male children, then I've got to be allowed to keep on having male children, otherwise I don't have a game. Not that that was the game that I really wanted.
Yeah, it sounds like your game ended as soon as you had... Like, did you have other mechanics that you could have interacted with or other systems?
No.
Whoa!
It was very limited that way. Yeah. And we had one woman who had actually been in a male character role, who then got killed in that role, and then it was picked up one of the similar roles to us. And so she got this extremely different version of the game, from being really interesting and excited and out there with all the battles and all of this sort of stuff, to suddenly having to get yourself married and produce the baby, which, you know, I think, well, it might have been a really good experience for a male to see what it was like to be a female in those times, that your only agency was really producing the male heirs. I think a male would find it a lot harder to play, and I think controls would find it really difficult to actually manage male players in a female role, because in a sense they don't pick up, they don't realize the sort of things that happen for women. It's the interrupting of by a male of a female talking that still happens today. There's sort of a lot of, you know, you could call them microaggressions, but it's sort of like they're the things that we still put up with, you know. And unfortunately, we then had a follow-on incident where one of the women didn't want to have a baby and was sort of threatened in terms of, well, I could make you. And the woman didn't want to make a fuss, and none of the guys that were around called the guy on his behavior, you know. And to me, it was the response of, you know, it would have been nice if the woman had felt in a position to be able to call that behavior, but the men are the ones that also were standing there, and by not saying anything, the men actually were complicit in it. And I think it was up, you know, when they sort of had heard after the game and some of the debriefing, the men were sort of really supportive of the women, but they needed to actually make some of those stands in the actual game as well. So at a number of multiple levels, there were things that went disastrously wrong, but it has meant that there's been a lot of discussion about how do we manage this and how do we deal with this, and, you know, what is the right way to design things that are actually going to be a lot more inclusive. And, I mean, we're talking about women, but how often does the same thing happen with any other grouping, you know? Sort of, it's not just women in particular, but that's what we're looking at the moment. Sorry, I get a bit worked up about this.
No, I there's really so much to unpack here, and I feel like just in you talking about that, there's like five different threads I want to pick up on, right?
I know, yeah.
But I think there's one thing that I think is worth just flagging, because I think I hadn't actually really made that connection as much, but it really came through when we were chatting, was there's a really big difference between the kind of agency you give to players, right? So the example we're talking about, the sort of Charles I game, we were both in roles where our agency was political agency, essentially, right? And that was the same agency that, actually, we were quite unusual as women at the time to have that political agency, but within the context of the game, you know, the sort of form of our agency was exactly the same as that of a man. Whereas in the Greek game, because of the difference in the historical setting, the agency that as a woman you're able to employ is totally different. So the perspective of trying to make strong historical characters is, okay, these are strong historical characters, but the way they express agency is incredibly gendered. And I think that's where, if you're a designer and you're looking at a setting and going, okay, a particular one to look at is, you know, do women, by the nature of the sort of discrimination and you know, society that was operating at the time, is the nature of their power gendered? And you know, really, even in the Charles I game, my character's power came from the fact that she was married to the king. You know, it's yet again, you know, the power is deriving from that you know, relationship with a male character, you know. So I think it's really one to watch for, because I think, like you said, Deborah, you know, I think we as women still face a lot of discrimination in the world today, and it's, I think, one of the ways that this can be even harder is that you're in that role, you're facing this discrimination in a game, and it is almost sort of too real.
Oh, it triggers so much stuff. Yep. And I don't think sometimes that the men are actually aware of what sorts of things that can do to a woman. But, you know, I've come from a background with a very violent father. I had, in one of the games I was in, someone threatened, you know, it was sort of like it wasn't, you know, like a bad thing, but it triggered me. And it sort of got a mouthful around that. And, I mean, I have to accept that that was my own stuff and he'd caught me on off guard around it. But there are so many, I like to say that actually that there's, you can always assume that there's trauma in the room of some sort. So we do need to be careful how we handle this sort of stuff. And we do need to make sure that we, I think, debrief at the end of these things to make sure that people aren't going home traumatized or people aren't going out without the some level of, you know, support and someone that's going to follow up and make sure that they've got the support that they need outside of the game context if something goes particularly pear-shaped. And I guess I'm just very conscious in gender situations that happens, and I'm sure in a lot of other areas it happens as well.
Yeah, I'd like to make a point about the two about the two games mentioned before we move on.
Yeah,
is I think these two points illustrate kind of the classic pitfall of including, like, of stressing gender in these historical designs, because clearly it you know, if I was the designer of funeral games, you know, I think the point of the game is to emulate, like, you know, the post Alexander political stuff and just all that. And it seems clear from the example given that the role of women at the time is not fun. So, like, why, I would say, why include it in your game? And if you do, just, like, you know, make it ahistorical, right? To fit the feel of the theme of what is your point, right? But also, to the Charles V.
First, you fell out the window, interestingly. I'm still trying to get my head around that one.
I was heartbroken. My husband was murdered.
I was waiting for the big beheading, and next minute he fell out of a window.
That design choice to include female roles, even in and even those roles as high as monarchs, I think is hugely risky, because the best case scenario, it appears likely anyways, is that you get treated essentially like a man with a few tweaks, right? Yeah. But the worst case scenario is so much worse. Like, that game could have ended up the same as funeral games if the rules were structured different, if the player base was different. It's incredibly, incredibly tricky. I'm not sure how to feel, if, because clearly, it was fun for you guys to embody. I don't mean to put words in your mouth, so please correct me if I'm mistaken. But it was fun for you guys to act like a queen. You know what I mean? Just,
yeah. Some of the girls are just so dressed up. They were just amazing. I was a lady in waiting. I said the girls are just so well, you know. I mean, but a lot of the guys came dressed up as well. But yeah, the girls had some, like, you women, you ladies, had some wonderful costumes. I just turned up in my trousers.
Yeah, I think anyone who saw me at that game could definitely attest to the fact that I had a fantastic time swanning around, essentially in a ball gown and tiara.
Yeah, no, it was incredibly, incredibly memorable.
The two games certainly make a good case study. It'd be interesting to, you know, it sounds like the main difference was the rules around, you know, the focus of the game was essentially making babies, which I think is a huge misstep.
Yeah, well, I think it was, you know, I genuinely think it is an effort by the men, the male designers, to try and create roles that they think will be interesting for the women. It is really interesting what the men think will be interesting for the women. This came up in a conversation, because I led a design session in the Chestnut Lodge sort of design conference that they had, and it was just fascinating what they assumed that. I mean, either I'm a very unusual woman, which I think I am, but you know, you know, I don't think I'm that different from a lot of women in the sorts of things that I actually enjoy in the games. I mean, for me, one of the first things, the more that we talked about this, one of the first things that we thought about in terms of a game design, because, you know, it can be interesting having both male and female roles, but was this aspect of agency, because, you know, I think the question is, you know, if a man was playing this woman character, would he have plenty to keep himself busy and occupied and engaged? You know, I mean, would a man really enjoy trying to get himself married off to some, you know, high stake Greek man, and producing a male, you know, and that's it? Would that be such a really engaging game for a guy? And if it's not, then why would it be engaging for a woman? You know, that is the question.
Yeah, yeah, it seems like a great, great point.
Yeah, so to me, like, design principle number one would have to be, you know, is a guy prepared, you know, is a guy really wanting to play that role of that woman, that character, that female character, because it's such a great meaty role, in which case a woman might actually want to play it as well. And I think that, and if they don't, then that needs to be a non-played position. You know, they could have had a card that you got that was, you know, telling a player who their wife was, or, you know, that sort of thing. There wasn't enough in it from the actual female role. So to me, I always think that would have to be a key design, a key design principle, whether you've got all men or all women or a mixture.
Yeah, I think we're in general agreement here, and this is true with pretty much any, you know, I have my fingers in a couple other kind of historical simulation communities, and the broader consensus is that you can include, you know, controversial topics around gender or whatever in the design, right? But just because you're role-playing as a misogynist doesn't mean you can actually act like a misogynist. And so that's one. And then two, I think, is the other thing that, Deborah, you just nailed the net here, right? Is like, if the design isn't fun, you know what I mean? Like, what are you doing? Like, you can't, and it's beyond, like, I hate to say that the trauma stuff is horrible and people need to be completely, like, more aware of that type of thing. But also from a game design perspective, that does not pass the mustard, you know? Anyway, so we solved it, guys. We solved it.
Well, the other aspect, I think one of the, you know, I've got a couple of principles here that I hammered out with these guys. How do you switch, or how does anyone switch from thinking about the design of a male character, and most of the historical stuff is about male characters, to thinking about the female characters and roles, whether it's going to be played by a man or played by a woman? I mean, if, for example, all the male characters are gathering around a military map, what are the female characters gathering around?
Yeah, so I'll hop off. This is potentially not the best example because it was not, it's not historical, but it's, what do you call it, historically inspired. It was my game based on the 1920 plus universe, which anyone can Google. It's alt history, post-World War I, Eastern Europe. Yeah, and so, you know, for that game, I wanted to appeal to a broad base of people, but I know the actual game mechanics are actually, you know, they don't appeal to everyone, right? Yeah. It's the game mechanics of the game that I based off of, which was the National Security Decision-Making Game, which was kind of a whole established system, is very argumentative-based. It's very, like, it's a lot of the stuff that you need to do is consensus-based, which means it's a lot of horse trading, which also can sometimes, depending on the player personalities, amount to, you know, like pseudo-bullying a little bit, and a lot of other, you know, kind of unsavory stuff if you don't want to get into the mud pit, right?
Yeah.
Like, and I wanted to have roles that you know, appeal to people who aren't interested in that, right? And so that was kind of a starting point for me to think about, you know, what to include, like how to include roles that were potentially, you know, a bit more go along and get along, and like, you know, those that appealed to kind of women who wanted to make their mark and stuff like that, who were playing the game. One of the things I ended up doing, and I'm not saying this is perfect or anything or completely all encompassing, I viewed the folk hero roles as which were kind of apolitical but had a bit more of an RPG path designed for them, where they had essentially a preset narrative that they could play off of, which was one, I think, good for those who weren't wanting to step into the mud pit of politics, and two, it allowed those who, you know, this was their first mega game, right? Which, you know, if you're female, it's a good chance that whatever mega game you're playing, it might be your first. it would help them out a little bit more. Because, you know, you don't want to be thrown into a mega game and not have any ground, you know, so.
Yeah, I usually find out what's the movie that they've based this on, and I watch the movie.
That's good, yeah. I mean, but in terms of, like, you know, how to get into the head of a woman is, like, you know, that, you know, there's been Tom Cruise movies made about this. Like, it's hard. It's not easy.
Well, it's also the same for us. I mean, you know, women probably think that they've got men all summed up, but, you know, how do we really get into the head of a man? I mean, I found something really interesting as a writer. I read this woman who, what she does is she actually chooses, she's got about four characters based on real, you know, four real life people who she has as her alpha males. And you know, she knows them inside out. She's read their biographies. She's, you know, found out everything about these. And she gets to a certain point in her novel writing, and she'll say, okay, what does, you know, like, it could be Sean Connery, it could be whatever. Yeah, we'll use Sean Connery. What would Sean Connery think in this situation? Or what would Boris think in this situation? And so her way of getting into the male head is to actually have a couple of people that she's identified as sort of alpha males, and has got to know them so well that she can sort of come in at the question from that perspective. So I sometimes think it would be really interesting for men to have something similar with women, that they get to actually know some really high profile characters and really get inside their head and think about, okay, what would this woman actually respond like?
Do you have any recommendations off the top of your head?
Off the top of my head, well, it just depends. I mean, you know, Michelle Obama comes to mind. You know, she often comes to mind with me. I think, you know, how she thinks about things would be interesting, and probably quite a contrast to someone like Maggie Thatcher. You know, sort of, I think having a variety of different characters that you actually get to know would be quite interesting. I mean, and it could be a sports person. It could be an actress, it could be politician, you know, in the same way as, you know, I would pick Steve Waugh as one of our cricketers, you know, Australian cricketer. He's got a really strong leadership style and that sort of thing. So, yeah, and I mean, I guess when you're writing, you'd have to resonate to some extent with with the people that you pick. You know, Mother Teresa's biography is out there somewhere, probably. You know, it just depends what the characters and the roles are that you're wanting. But I think that would be one way.
It's tough because yeah. this is the type of, we've been going back and forth here, and I'm going to summarize broadly. But you know, one of the things that I've been kind of saying is that good game design is universal, right? And so a lot of these, unfortunately, gendered game decisions, you know, that the missteps anyways, you know, obviously you can have a gendered game mechanic that ends up being super good. You know, they aren't good on a basic game mechanic level, right?
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, I'm not saying we're arguing or anything, right? But one of the points that you're making, Deborah, is that in order for these game decision missteps to be avoided, you really need to get into the mindset of the other gender, right?
Well, if you're wanting to have some of those distinctions a bit broader, then I mean, you're looking at it from one perspective, which is almost like gender neutral, for lack of a better way of putting it. And I'm saying I think that is one way through it. But then if you have got some roles that are and I think this was the advantage, I think, with the one that we did on Charles I. In a sense, you could get into the head. I could get into the head of the character I'd been given. I could look up a life story and really get to grips with, okay, this is the way she was using her power, her position. This is what she did. And I quite enjoy that, doing that sort of background stuff.
So you were a lady in waiting, right? What was the actual character?
She was quite interesting. I can't remember who she is. It must be a couple of years ago now.
I've looked up the name of the character you played, Deborah, and she was called Lucy Hay.
Countess of Carlisle. Very cool.
That's right. The Lucy Hay, Countess of Carlisle. That's right. Yeah, she was a bit conniving, I think. One of the things I find really interesting is, and with this group of guys that I'd been doing this talk with, it was interesting seeing what they assumed that women actually, they thought that women actually liked roles that were more like political intrigue and influencing and those sorts of roles. Mm. And what I said to them, well, you know, fortunately I had prepared for that bit, because I said, well, it might be interesting, you know, again, this is just one person's perspective, but, you know, as a kid, I loved the actress Maureen O'Hara, you know, the redheaded actress. She was always in the adventurous swashbuckling movies. I really loved, you know, Captain Blood, you know, all the swashbuckling movies. I would want to play, you know, if I had a chance, I mean, I can't be Princess Leia anymore, but I'd be Commander Organa, you know. I would be Kara Starbuck Thrace in Battlestar Galactica, you know, the hotshot Viper pilot.
Deborah, can I hit pause real quick? I'm interested, but I have to say that's like a really, it's a really, am I stating the obvious here and saying like that's a really sexist thought, right, to assume that? Because when I think of political intrigue in mega games too, I oftentimes view that as very emotionally brutal, you know? It involves backhand deals and backstabbing and yelling, and like if you're new to mega games, one, and two, not used to like the male chauvinism like backslapping, right? Like, you know, that's not Okay, anyways, I just needed a sanity check.
I much prefer being a pirate, or make me a spy, or make me a warrior. You know, it's that's a sort of, you know, even at 65, that's where I'm wanting to go, you know. And what was really interesting was when I sort of got these people that I wanted to play, and I sort of did a bit of analysis on it, and I thought, okay, they're all strong-willed, they're all fiery, they're all determined, they're all impetuous, you know, and I thought, you know, there's all these things that the guys don't actually think are the sorts of things that I'm wanting to play, which was really interesting. And you know, I don't particularly like being around the table and trying to influence what's going on. I don't know about you, Maddie. What sorts of games do you like playing? What sort of roles?
So, I mean, it depends on the context and the game for me generally. I know that in mega games, I tend to prefer more political roles, partly because I'm more of a, I prefer interacting with people rather than sort of pushing counters around a table. But that preference is more around the kind of interaction I like to have at a game. I think it's I mean, I completely agree with you, Peter, you know, just assumptions about women like to play these kind of roles and men like to play these kind of roles. I mean, it's completely sexist. And, you know, to some extent, it's a reflection of the society we live in, right? You know, there's still pink is for girls, blue is for boys. There's a lot of that stuff just still around in the society we're in. And so to an extent, I think there's, you know, inevitably some of that is going to bleed into, you know, just interactions that you have at mega games, because mega games sit within the real world.
We've been talking a lot about gender. I guess I should mention my As Thou Commands design briefly. So one historically inspired project, and it's not historical by any means, but it's a historically inspired project that I did recently, was a brief kind of mega game playtest that I did for a design called As Thou Commands. And so, As Thou Commands, I think it's a pretty interesting game, but we're not going to talk about the actual game design. What I thought I'd mention briefly is what I did with to kind of expand the inclusivity of everything. So, As Thou Commands, it takes place, and I wanted it to emulate the power politics of medieval Europe as strictly as possible, while still leaving room for a certain amount of players to have agency, right? So the design was informed by the CPG Grey YouTube video, Rules for Rulers, which I highly recommend for anyone interested in that type of thing. But essentially, the moral of this political philosophy outlined in this video, and the video is based on a book, and I've called The Dictator's Handbook. But essentially, if you're at the top, you depend on the people below you. And so you have to deposit the wealth in a manner that benefits the people who are supporting you, and they have to do the same to the people below them, and it just goes down and down and down and down. And so the design itself had a series of dukes who were supported below them by a lesser nobility of marquises, counts and stuff, barons or whatever. But important to that is I also wanted to make, you know, this medieval like power arrangement, additional to making it a little bit more democratic and a bit more straightforward, I wanted to make it a bit more inclusive to everyone, which I admittedly found kind of daunting at the beginning when I first started the project, right? So what I did was I went ahead and wrote a tonal guide, and it ended up being several pages long. And I can talk about the whole tonal guide, but essentially, in summary, what it came down to is in reality, a lot of it could be shortened to probably like 3 or 4 paragraphs that would explain that even though this is a medieval universe, we're applying the norms and beliefs of like contemporary time, and yep. You know, make a few specific points about what exactly those contemporary beliefs are, just for to fill in those not in the know. The reason my tonal brief was so long was because the universe was fictional, and so I wanted to really make it affirmatively tackle and stuff like that. But if you were doing a more realistic or even a more fictional universe, I kind of had the awkward middle ground of being historically inspired but also fictional. That entire tonal guide likely could be shorter. So I talked about it a bit more in depth on a previous podcast with the Great Game folks. So if you're interested in that, I recommend checking them out. But I'll be happy to include the tonal guide to Maddie so she can include it in the show notes.
Yeah, I'll make sure we link to various things, because I remember you sent round a sort of early draft, and I remembered looking at it and just going, well, this should be in all mega games basically that have any sort of historical one. I guess not necessarily, because you know it's a bit down to the designer, but I remember you sent round an early draft of it, and being quite impressed by, you know, how comprehensive it was.
It is a bit like, you know, having the code of practice, that sort of thing. Code of conduct, yeah. I think those sorts of things are really helpful to just bring some of this stuff to light. And it's not the most exciting thing to revisit, but, you know, I think for mega game groups, for any sort of groups, it's really useful to sit down and to look at those sorts of things through not only the lens of gender, but race and, you know, socioeconomic status and so on. I know some of our designers. I know Jim, for example, has got his own business and has got one. And it came up at Mega Game Conference this year. Yeah, but really, really important to have those. I mean, if nothing else, I mean, they might not be perfect, but at least they get people thinking, they get people talking about it. It's raising the awareness about some of these issues, and that's got to be good.
And I think there's definitely an important aspect, particularly around historical mega games, where, you know, one of the incidents that we kind of mentioned earlier on was essentially revolving around players quite often accidentally thinking this is a historical mega game, and acting historically accurately means being sexist or being racist or, you know, basically being discriminatory. And as designers and organizers, we have to be really clear that behavior is not acceptable. And I think things like a tonal guide and code of conduct are really important for signaling, you know, for really, really clearly showing that behavior is not going to be tolerated.
Yeah. It's really, and it's important to stress how for all these mega games, the point of the game is, I would say, almost never to emulate the gender sufferings. I've never played a mega game where the point of the game was to explore how, like, the war of the sexes or whatever, right?
Yeah.
And so just don't do it. Don't bring that into this game. It's not important to the historical theming. It may be historically real, but it's not part of the point. Yeah. I guess one final note I forgot to mention about the tonal guide is, so I actually made a first draft, and looking back, the first draft is not good. So the way I got to the first draft to the final tonal guide, which I think is much better, is through feedback from other people. And so anyone interested in that type of, like, really making a, you know, a inclusive game, I you know, you really gotta play test this type of thing and get feedback.
The discussions are a really big part of the learning. Yeah.
So that is what I would encourage. Maddie, I assume you are just jumping in to wrap everything up right now.
Well, Pete and I will wrap it up. Well, I can say it's been really great being here, Maddie and Peter. Lovely to meet you online, Peter. And all the best for your future games and game design.
Yes, thanks, Maddie, for having me on, and thanks you, Deborah, for the lovely conversation. Let's have more in the future.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Our thanks to Deborah and Peter for taking the time to virtually sit down with Matty and have a little bit of a chat. I think that was a really interesting conversation. Are you happy with how it came out, Matty?
Yes, really happy, and thank you particularly at the end for being so patient with all my audio issues. I cut out all the parts where we're kind of going, hello, you cut out to each other.
Now, once again, you're lifting the curtain. People would have thought this was a seamless technical masterpiece on your behalf.
Yeah, we're really good with technology over here at the Mega Game Assembly, being nerds and all.
It's okay. I think you covered it quite nicely. I think we got away with it.
Yeah. And yeah, thank you to Deborah and Peter for basically wrapping up the episode for me.
It's good to have a fill-in host when things go wrong.
Yes, very they handy. Stepped up admirably.
And thank you also to you guys at home for listening. If you'd like to look at any of the links for the things that were spoken about during the episode, you should find them in the show notes of this podcast, or you can head along to the Mega Game Assembly website. While you're there, you can also check out calendars, you can check out blogs, you can check out past episodes of the podcast, and hopefully some other Mega Gaming resources that you may find useful.
Speaking of calendars, Harrison, didn't we have some exciting events happening in March?
Yes, and it's thank you very much for reminding me. I was testing you. See, that's what I was doing. I hadn't forgotten. I was just making sure that you hadn't forgotten.
Of course, yeah.
But yes, we are very happy to announce that we will be hosting MegaCon from Friday the 19th to Sunday the 21st of March in 2021. Depending on when you're listening to this podcast, this announcement may be useless to you, or it may be very exciting to you. Hopefully it's the latter. If you head over to megacon.org.uk, you will find all the details and all the various different seminars and mega games and playtests that are being held, and you may hear some familiar voices in some of those, I believe.
Yes, Deborah is going to be doing a seminar on We Need to Talk About Women in War Games, and Peter's also going to be doing another playtest of the game that we talked about a little bit on the podcast, As Thou Commands. So if you found that conversation interesting, then check those out.
For the playtest, you will need the MegaCon ticket plus the As Thou Commands ticket, but the As Thou Commands ticket is free, and for the seminar by Deborah, that will just be included as part of your MegaCon ticket.
Amazing.
So yes, if you enjoyed the conversation you've just heard, I would definitely recommend getting along to those seminars, and while you're over there, check out the other fun and exciting stuff that's happening at MegaCon, and we hope to see you there. So until next time, thank you very much for downloading, and goodbye.
Bye.